And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, April 28th. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. On this episode, promotions and demotions galore. Two pitching prospects up in Cleveland.
Wait, did I get demoted?
You're still here.
Nobody told me.
Still here for now.
Did I get promoted?
No, you're still here.
I was hoping to move up to a better podcast. I'm going to have my agent call the GM.
You have only been here 2 years, so I think you've got 11 years to go.
I refuse to accept that I am a quadruple A podcaster.
I don't know.
I'm not okay with this.
Writing's on the wall, Keith.
I am too young. I'm not too young for anything. I can't even get that sentence out.
See, if it was going to happen, it would have happened for you by now.
Never say never. Spirit of Drew Maggi. Gift of the Maggi, right?
Gift of the Maggi.
13 years in the minors, 33, pushing 34 years old. Gets his first day in the big leagues. How can you not be romantic about baseball?
Drafted back in 2010. You saw him back at ASU, right?
I saw him. He was a pain in the ass kind of player. And I say that as a good thing. And God, I should pull that out. 2020. That Arizona State. I mean, this is when Arizona State, the scouts used to call it MLBU, right? They would just churn out so many players. Jordan Swaggerty. There's a blast from the past. Who else was still on that club? Devin Marrero was on that club. Brady Rogers. He got to the big leagues. Did Zach Wilson? That Zach Wilson, I don't think, got to the big leagues, but I did see him homer off Garrett Cole. Or Seth Blair. He never got there. There he is, Drew Maggi. He was not 6 feet. That is a dirty lot. There's no way that guy is 6 feet tall, right? No. You can't play like that and be 6 feet tall. Like, I feel like that's also not possible. If you play like he plays, you have to be 5'7". Right? There's just an upper bound. Then you're not scrappy.
Right.
You're not a grinder.
It's just an incredible story because showing up every day for 13 years and having what looked like pretty clear and convincing evidence that you couldn't get to the big leagues, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
To keep with it. So yep. Many other players have gone down that path, had similar or even better results, and just called it a career. Yep. Because the grind took them down.
Josh Spence got to the big leagues, but the two biggest names who were on that club, Merrill Kelly and Cole Calhoun, all on that Arizona State team. So how many big leaguers? That's 6 or 7 big leaguers. Like, some of these guys might have gotten a day somewhere along the line. I remember a lot of these guys got drafted and were prospects at some point. But in terms of actually getting the big leagues, that's pretty good.
Marrero, I think of the names you mentioned, was the earliest draft pick of all of them, wasn't he?
He was an actual first rounder.
Yeah,
he could have been probably a first rounder out of high school. He was completely unsignable. I remember seeing him in high school because I think he was Eric Hosmer's teammate. Might have been a year behind, but we saw him a little bit in high school. And the next spring, if I remember correctly, was like, don't even bother. He is going to school, which turned out to be true. And obviously, he turned out to be a first rounder. He never really fulfilled expectations. I actually thought he was going to be a better big leaguer because I thought, you know, what I always say is the hardest thing ultimately to assess in any amateur position players, how much can they hit? But it kind of looked like he could hit. He hit pretty well in school. He hit well for the Team USA. If I remember correctly, hit well in the Capes a long time ago. I may be getting some of the settings wrong. And he just didn't hit. It just didn't translate to the wood bat. And hitting professional pitching is a lot harder.
It is very difficult, as we will talk about throughout this show. So as mentioned up top, tons of moves since you and I last spoke. Two for the Cleveland Guardians. Both Logan Allen, the second Logan Allen they've had, the other Logan Allen. The first Logan Allen from Cleveland is now in Colorado. Logan Allen and Tanner Bibee are both up. And they've had a lot of injuries. Of course, Tristan McKenzie is on the 60-day IL right now. Aaron Savali's got an oblique injury. They've tried to use some of their lesser organizational depth. And now it kind of seems like they have to stick with the younger prospects that they brought up. Allen and Bibee bring so much more to the table. And I think they have to be excellent in the rotation and excellent in the bullpen because they still are not scoring enough runs. They're 24th in WRC Plus entering play on Thursday. The way they're built, they're tempering strikeouts just like they did last season, but they're second to last in homers. They only hit 13 homers so far this season, and that's the problem they had a year ago. They were 29th in home runs last season. While it's amazing, the Yankees led the league in home runs last year. I mean, having Aaron Judge last year helped. The Yankees hit twice as many, literally twice as many home runs as the Guardians. So this is a team that needs to be so good pitching-wise. It seems like they can't mess around anymore with the Connor Pilkingtons and the Peyton Battenfields and some of the other guys they've had in and out of that rotation this season.
Yeah, didn't they actually DFA Connor Pilkington? Was he the DFA to clear a roster spot for Bibee? I think that's right. But to your overall point, I don't really understand the teams we see, and Cincinnati's done this too. They're in a different position in terms of their window of contention, but I think the point generally stands. Stop messing around with guys who are pretty clearly not major league starters or extremely unlikely to be major league starters or maybe have nothing beyond a fifth starter ceiling when you have better alternatives sitting there in the high minors. For Cleveland, it was particularly Tanner Bibee, Logan Allen also, Gavin Williams. We can talk about those guys as well. Whereas for Cincinnati, I even tweeted the other day, why is Andrew Abbott still in AA? He's actually not. He's now in AAA. But at that point, he was striking out close to two-thirds of batters he faced in AA with increased velocity, but the same secondary characteristics on the fastball that made it fairly effective last year. But takes him from, hey, this guy's a nice number five starter to a number three or better. And you're just wasting bullets. With all of these guys, you're probably just wasting bullets and making the big league team worse. Now, in Cleveland's case, it's probably costing you games because you don't have the run prevention you need when you have an offense that's pretty clearly below the median. In Cincinnati's case, it's less about contention, more about, do you want to ask your bullpen to give you 7 1/3 every night? Probably not. Not the ideal way to run a pitching staff, regardless of how many games you think you're going to win over the course of the season. So good for Cleveland for calling Bibee up, who, by the way, was even better than I expected, and I thought I was reasonably high on him coming into the season. Cincinnati, you know, a partial credit. You got Abbott to AAA. That's not actually the majors. It's close. It is in the right direction. Hopefully we will see Abbott in the majors sooner rather than later, because I think the worst outcome here, you don't bring this guy up, whoever your guy or pitching, you know, could be multiple guys, your top pitching prospect, you don't bring him up. Service time, or you think they're working on something, you lose more games because you're using inferior options, and then your guy maybe gets hurt because you just sort of waited too long, and because pitchers always get hurt at some point. So I'm glad to see Bibee come up. I hope Williams comes up soon. I hope Abbott comes up soon.
Yeah, I think when you look at this Guardians organization, you see Daniel Espino unfortunately having another setback with his arm. He made four starts last season at AA, Keith. I think from a talent perspective, many people thought he was ready to contribute, maybe even last year, probably was going to contribute this year if he was healthy. Now it's a question as to whether or not we're even going to see him, depending on what the latest setback actually reveals. But even with that potential loss, Gavin Williams is bumped up to AAA, and he was excellent his first three starts at AA. So they may have another big league ready starter sitting there waiting in the wings at Columbus. And I know they've got a lot of good position player prospects. Plenty of them, but compared to the pitching depth they have, it seems like they need to maybe consider making a trade, trading a controllable young starter, or maybe trading a veteran. I mean, doing something a little unconventional and really letting the youth sort of take over, because they have these flaws that I don't know that they can fix internally in the lineup. When you look at Brian Rocchio, Will Brennan, who's already up, Bo Naylor, who's at AAA, we've talked about him a little bit on the show. So the prospects they've got on the position player side, like, are they going to get a lot better with any in-season promotions from that group of position players?
You know, George Valera he's the one on the position player side who I thought could make some sort of difference, because I thought that he's got a chance for real power, right? And that's just something they're lacking. Now, there's some swing and miss concern with him. He's also generally been very young for where he's played. He's advanced pretty quickly. Has also lost some playing time here and there to random injuries, not long-term concerns, but I think he's even a little younger in baseball terms than his age would indicate. I'm pretty high on him. I don't know that he has the impact right away. I think long-term, this guy's got quite a bit of power upside. That's probably it in terms of potential real difference makers for them this year on the position player side. And on the pitching side, I agree with your larger point that they need to make a trade at some point. They've got various surpluses from which they can trade too, with a reasonably strong farm system kind of all the way through and pretty some depth, I think, on both sides of the ball in the system. Losing Espino really hurts, though. That is, I mean, there were whispers that he had something amiss with his shoulder all the way back in high school, but Cleveland took him in the first round. And he stayed healthy that summer. We had a pandemic year. He stayed basically healthy all through 21. He made those four starts at the beginning of 22 where he looked like the best pitching prospect in all of baseball. And he hasn't pitched in a game since. And with multiple setbacks to the shoulder, I just don't know. I slid him down about 20 spots, I would say, in my offseason top 100, which was, you know, a little throw my hands up, right? I don't know. Everyone's saying he's fine. If you ask all the Cleveland people, et cetera, he was supposed to be good to go. And then it broke again, or he was broken the whole time. Who knows? At this point, I have just zero expectation we're going to see him back this year. And Cleveland just has to operate like he's there. We're going to rehab him, but he's not going to impact the major league club this year. And he probably doesn't have any trade value either. So if they're looking to make a big trade, they're going to have to look elsewhere into their stable of both of arms and of position player prospects where they do have some surplus, I think, beyond Valera, who's a little bit of a unicorn in that system, or a little bit unusual in that system in that he has that big power upside.
Yeah, I think because of pitching injuries around the league and just general needs around the game any given time, having pitching to trade is never a bad thing. You could always flip pitching and get quality position players back. Shane Bieber, atop that rotation, becomes a free agent after 2024. I think we can both reasonably assume that the Guardians are not going to extend Shane Bieber. He's probably going to be pitching somewhere else, maybe even before his time in Cleveland comes up at the end of 2024. They may make him the trade piece. I know he's not as old as Corey Kluber was, and they traded Corey Kluber, but they've shown us this blueprint once before. That was the Emmanuel Class A trade a couple of years ago. So maybe it's Bieber who ends up getting the bump outside the organization via trade.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's get to some other moves. Taj Bradley was sent down to AAA Durham. He looked really good in his first three starts, Keith. And one of the things that was mentioned in the story that Mark Topkin, who covers the team for the St. Petersburg Times, I think is the paper, Tampa Tribune, the Tampa paper, is that they wanted to get him adjusted to an every fifth day schedule. You'll notice if you look at how often he's pitched this year, it is every 6 days so far.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should buy that entirely at face value. I understand the Rays want to be careful with Taj Bradley. He's a big part of their future. How long would it take to reasonably make that sort of transition in season anyway? And is this one of those cases where, as great as the Rays might be, they might be getting a little too cute, kind of throwing Yanni Chirinos and Josh Fleming and some of those guys out there for innings in the early part of the season instead of Taj Bradley?
I wonder if they feel like they're playing with house money a little bit because their record is so good. I'm not saying I would necessarily agree with that. I wonder if that's just kind of their thinking. It depends. The answer to your question really depends on the pitcher. I mean, some pitchers have no problem switching And we obviously ask guys to do this all the time in high school and in college. They pitch once a week and they come into pro ball and we immediately shift them to every 6 day or sometimes immediately every fifth day. The goal obviously is to get them towards every fifth day over time. So it can be done. It can definitely be done over the course of a single season. I would ask, if that was your intention, why didn't you do this in March? Just wondering.
Yeah.
Like, why would you start a guy out pitching every sixth day in AAA with the idea that at some point we're going to call this guy up to the majors where he'll pitch every fifth day? That seems to lack foresight. I also don't think Tampa Bay typically lacks foresight, which makes me ask more questions. I don't really love seeing that kind of thing happening on the fly. I also don't think it's going to take all that much time. And Bradley did pitch really well in the big leagues. So maybe it's two or three turns down in the minors. And as long as everything holds up, his velocity is the same, secondary characteristics on a stop ball looks the same, he's not reporting more fatigue, great, we're good to go.
I would guess what they would want to do is maybe lower the pitch count slightly on the shorter schedule and then ramp it up. So he's thrown 78, 84, and 82 pitches in his last three starts, going back to that debut against the Red Sox on April 12th. If they want to knock 20 pitches off that, put him in the 60s, mm-hmm. have him throw 10 more 5 days later, and then 10 more 5 days after that, he's right back mm-hmm. to where he was when he got sent down. And between now and then, you know, maybe they have a slightly deeper bullpen the way they're running the roster. Okay, maybe there's some other tactical reason they have for doing this. I just think it's really odd. It's the kind of move that makes people very cynical about service time also, because he looks like he more than belongs in their core five yeah. right now, especially with Tyler Glasnow out. I think if this were, if Taj Bradley's demotion were the corresponding move when Tyler Glasnow came off the IL, I think people could handle that a little bit easier and say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Tyler Glasnow is excellent. You got this extra really good young starter. You're going to send him down for a little while. But this isn't that. This is using some guys that are nice innings eaters, I think is the way I would describe both Chirinos and Fleming. And usually you're trying to use those guys less as opposed to using them at the expense of someone that is a difference maker.
That absolutely makes sense. Yep. I don't understand. Like I said, the only argument I could make for what the Rays are doing is they're thinking we're winning. We're doing so well. We can mess around with the guys we have in terms of filling that last rotation spot. That seems pretty temporary. I mean, you just look at what's happened to a bunch of other clubs that have tried that, like the two we were just talking about earlier. Don't dig yourself a hole. Yes, you have this great lead. You're also probably in the toughest division in baseball. I would maybe not take any of that for granted.
No, a 4-game lead over the Blue Jays on April 27th doesn't mean that much. It's a great start. It's good to have those wins in the bank, but there's a long way to go. A lot of baseball to still be played. The Rays, I think, were upstaged by the Cardinals, sending Jordan Walker down. Like, Taj Bradley's demotion, mm-hmm. I thought was going to be the most surprising thing of the week, and then the Cards came in and said, nah, hold my beer. Jordan Walker's going down. Defensively, things were not going well to begin the season, but as far as what he was doing at the plate, basically a league average hitter by WRC plus upon arrival after skipping AAA. I would define that as a successful run as a hitter by any mm-hmm. reasonable sort of metrics. Did Jordan Walker become more expendable to this front office temporarily because of their inability to move an outfielder during the offseason? This has been a problem since spring training began. You look at this depth chart and you see Walker, you'd see Lars Nootbaar and Tyler O'Neill. They want to play Alec Burleson. Dylan Carlson's still there. There's not quite enough playing time to go around when everybody's healthy. So how much of this is the result of the Cardinals' depth, and how much of it is a result of Jordan Walker's performance?
Yeah, it's pretty, I think, pretty telling that they slightly rushed Walker to the big leagues, not in the sense of, oh, he's clearly not ready. We saw some positives and some negatives from him, right? Certainly punching out more than a quarter of your plate appearances and not getting on base or hitting for a ton of power to compensate for that. Not ideal. It's also a tiny sample. It was 20. He played 20 games. So I'm not really drawing any big conclusions from that. I'm pretty sure they went into spring training not really thinking Jordan Walker was going to make the club. And they let his big spring training put him on the club, despite the fact that, as you said, they already had this outfield surplus that they kind of needed to sort through, which is what I assumed all along was Walker would start in the minors, if for no other reason than there wasn't any room to play him in the first place. And I also agree, I think, that they probably should have done something in the offseason. It's easy to sort of wave our hands around. They should have done a thing. They had a lot of outfielders, many of whom would play every day for at least a handful of clubs in the big leagues. They probably all start for Oakland at this point. So they could have done something to try to, you want to convert that, right? You get a surplus like that. You want to convert it into maybe one player who's better and upgrades you at a specific position. They did not do so. The comments that I saw after the fact were essentially, well, we need to figure out our outfield. And that's why we're sending Walker down. Well, if you need to figure out your outfield, why'd you have Walker up in the first place? And I don't think anybody's asked that question. And this would apply a little bit to this different situation, but to Anthony Volpe in New York, too. These guys are struggling out of the chute. They're both great prospects. I haven't changed my opinion on either player as a prospect. It's kind of what happens when you let spring training decide it, though. Right. That's not really the ideal way to decide roster spots, especially when we're talking about top prospects who will be very young for making their big league debuts. And in both these cases, the early returns are negative. That may be a different story by the end of the year, but right now, not great.
Prior to this season, Jordan Walker, counting the fall league last year, had played 52 games in the outfield as a pro.
Yeah.
So there was an actual, he needs to continue working on defense. Like, you could have played that in this instance, and it wouldn't have been nearly as egregious as most of the times that you get that explanation for a player going down. You might be right. It might be they couldn't justify it because he played so well during spring training and he was someone that they thought could do more than he did at the plate already, but it's just a tough scene right now. I think this Cardinals team desperately needs more pitching. We just talked about Cleveland being on the opposite side of the problem. These two teams actually line up pretty well on a potential trade because you could take a Tyler O'Neill and send him over to Cleveland and they get some thump and you could send pitching back. I don't think that'd be unreasonable at all. I think there are plenty of people out there that wonder, is this all we're going to get from Dylan Carlson? Because looking back at what he did in the upper levels of the minor league, specifically, it was Double A where he had that huge breakout season. There was power, mm-hmm. there was speed. It just looked like he was going to be the next great above average regular coming out of this system. And he's been, each of the last two seasons, he's been a 2.5 win player by Fangraphs WAR. That's a good player, especially for a guy who's 22, 23 years old. If there's not another level there, there's a pretty strong case for possibly trading him now. What do you do to resolve this? Who goes? Who is your preferred player to trade based on what you would likely get back from another club?
I mean, Carlson's, after Walker, the one I keep. He is only 24. I think that makes him the second youngest of all of their outfielders right now. He did have that upper level performance. He also needs to play regularly. The stupidest thing, I'm sorry, but it is. Is having Dylan Carlson on the roster and not playing every day. I just don't know what you're doing at this point. And that was another argument to not have Walker on the opening day roster, where what is the situation? What benefit is there from having Carlson and Alec Burleson, who's also 24? So I don't actually know which one's, obviously it's a matter of a few days or weeks. I don't know which one of those guys is younger, but both those guys need to be playing every day, probably in the big leagues. Carlson even more so since he was in the big leagues last year. Like, if this results, if all these shenanigans result in Carlson getting demoted at some point so he can get regular playing time. There was regular playing time available for him in the majors, but you haven't given it to him. I'm just looking right here. He's got fewer plate appearances than Burleson, O'Neill, or Walker, or Nolan Gorman, who's DH, listed as the DH, and is only slightly ahead of Lars Nootbaar, who at the very least is getting on base. So there's a really good argument to have Nootbaar playing more regularly because so far in only 48 plate appearances, he's getting on base at a 42% clip. To me, the guy I would move, it's the guy I've been saying I would move for over a year now. They should have traded Tyler O'Neill before 2022. The 2021 season looked like such a raging fluke compared to skill set, swing, track record, had this huge breakout. They didn't extend him, but they didn't try to capitalize either. And he collapsed last year. And he's somewhere in between, but still, it's a 309 on base percentage. And he's not hitting for a lot of power. That's kind of what you got from him last year. And he's 28. Now, I don't know that you could trade him for a lot, but you might be able to trade him for something. There will certainly be teams out there that would value some of the things he can do and think, hey, we're getting this guy maybe for 50 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, it's got to be a team that wants to play for now that needs the power. So Cleveland's among the teams that make a lot of sense, and they have to have some pitching to send back. I think, I don't know, maybe Tyler O'Neill for Cal Quantrill even is a reasonably fair trade, because Quantrill, I don't think he has a lot of ceiling, but he brings enough floor to take the ball every fifth day. I think he'd make the Cardinals rotation a little better than it's been. I think a move like that would actually make a lot of sense for both clubs, because it allows them to put their best combinations of players on the field on a more regular basis. I think Burleson is tough for me because in a world where Nolan Gorman continues to hit, and I think that's a very plausible sort of thing, he's really pressed to be a regular left fielder. Alec Burleson just does not look good in the outfield, Keith. He looks like he's built to be more of a DH. I think he's a tough player to justify keeping in the lineup on an everyday basis if they keep this entire group together. I think defense may ultimately cost him a lot of playing time.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, they've got quite a few of those guys. Nolan Gorman's not a strong defender. I think Nolan Gorman can, you know, he's shown, obviously, if you keep hitting like he has been hitting so far this year, it's obviously not going to matter so much, but definitely a lot of sins are certainly forgiven. He was not good at second base. He has not been good at second base when he's played it this year. He was not good at second base last year. I still think he could get better, but he's not a good defensive player. Tyler O'Neill, not a good defensive player. Alec Burleson, probably not a good defensive player. Jordan Walker needs work. Absolutely think he'll get there. I think the fact that he's sort of better, faster underway than he is in terms of first step, probably better suited to the outfield after all. So they can certainly move some guys around and maybe improve the defensive alignment, but they've got a couple of guys who are currently playing a bit out of positions, kind of like the Phillies were with Rhys Hoskins and still are to some extent, where it's, well, we just like the bats. Except in the Cardinals case, several of these guys we're talking about are also not hitting enough for you to cover your eyes and ignore what's going on defense.
The other question I think I have for you with the Cardinals is about Matthew Liberatore. He's pitching pretty well so far to start the season at AAA, 36-9 strikeout to walk ratio and 27 2/3, a sub 3 ERA, 1.14 whip, really the best ratios we've seen from him at any point since rookie ball. Is this going to be his opportunity here in the near future? And can he be more successful this time around after a pretty bumpy stretch in St. Louis last summer?
Yeah, well, my hope is that, and I know a little bit from talking to some people with St. Louis over the winter too, they're aware of what was going wrong, of why Liberatore had some issues, particularly with harder contact, quality of contact when he got to the big leagues. This is a guy who's almost certainly going to have to pitch less with his fastball, which a lot of guys do at this point, because I actually think he's got pretty good command. I've always liked his delivery. He's got good secondary stuff, but the fastball is just, it's kind of straight. Hitters pick it up. I mean, sometimes that's also just generally the curse of a good delivery, right? Is that hitters just see the ball. That was, I'll never forget, still guy who's still an executive. He was a scout at the time, but we were watching Luke Hochaver, who at that point was struggling to stick in the big leagues. And he said, I guess we all got fooled by the pretty delivery. And it just always has made me think too, maybe the really pretty deliveries, hitters think they're pretty too, because they see the ball really well. So I don't know. You know, on the flip side, so far this year, yeah, Liberatore has had some success. He's actually had a little more success with the fastball. He's sitting 94, 95, and he's getting more chases on the pitch. The curveball and the slider, I think, are both still plus. He's not throwing a lot of changeups. I think he's probably going to need to throw one more. But the biggest thing for me, it's just going to be how the fastball plays, where he's locating it. Has he changed enough on it that he can get some swings and misses, especially in zone? Or is that just going to be kind of a, you know, out of zone, he can get some out of zone chase, but in zone, he's going to have to work primarily with his other weapons because the four seamer is too true. I mean, that's been a bit of Nick Lodolo's issue, is he can't miss bats in the zone. He gets chases on the breaking ball. He has no changeup to speak of, right? He's right-handed hitters absolutely destroying him this year. And he comes at them with a fastball that doesn't have great life or shape to it. And so he can't miss bats in the zone with it. Again, particularly right-handers. And that's why he's struggling so much.
Yeah, I think when you look at this team, you see Jake Woodford holding that spot in the back of the rotation right now. I realize Adam Wainwright is on the IL, but I think that's the simple move, one of the simple moves the Cardinals can make that will help them potentially turn this very slow start around in the coming weeks.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
Joey Ortiz is up for the Orioles, a prospect that I know you like in that system quite a bit. How do you see him fitting in, and how long do you think this might last?
I don't know how long it's going to last, because I think part of this is because they got a couple guys who are just sort of slightly banged up. There's not really clear playing time. That said, Gunnar Henderson is not off to a great start, and maybe they decide at some point if Ortiz hits like he has hit so far, really since about the midpoint of last season. He raked in the second half last year in Double A. He was raking to start this year in Triple A, hitting for average and showing some extra base power. He can really play shortstop. Maybe they decide at some point they'll let Henderson go to Triple A for a little bit, just get a quick breather, and let Ortiz continue to play every day if Ortiz hits. And again, not changing any of my long-term outlook for Gunnar Henderson, just thinking if Ortiz is up and he's playing well. Obviously, Jorge Mateo is having this bizarre, completely out of character start. But if he keeps rolling like this and Ortiz is hitting, what do you do? You don't want to turn around and send Ortiz down at that point, especially once Mateo is 100% again. Maybe they do just move some guys around with the idea that Henderson is back in 3 weeks and starts playing regularly again after he gets just kind of, like I said, gets a quick breather, comes back up, and you hope that he performs more like what we saw at the end of last year.
Yeah, I still think the underlying numbers for Henderson are really encouraging. He's getting on base a lot for a guy that's struggling to hit for power. He's actually barreling the ball a little bit too for a guy that's not getting to that power very often. So it seems like a very good young player just making some adjustments to top-level pitching. You're right, they've got the flexibility to send him down for a little while if they want to. For now, Ortiz is actually going to make that big league debut on Thursday. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon at second base. So maybe it's just playing Adam Frazier a little bit less. That could be part of their plan as well. And I think that's fine.
That's another one. Yeah.
Make Adam Frazier a bench guy. That's not a crime.
Yep. Ramon Urias, like, these guys don't have to. They're nice. I mean, Frazier obviously is a little different because of how they brought him in, but still, like, they don't have to play every day. They're nice bench pieces. They're the guys you move on from when Joey Ortiz is ready, when Jordan Westberg, who's also off to a really nice start, when he's ready. You don't let those other guys stand in the way of bringing up your prospects who are clearly ready and who you know are the core of the Orioles lineup for the next 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, the Orioles are another one of those teams that could line up with the Guardians on a trade where you take a prospect position player and flip them for a prospect pitcher. And it wouldn't be it wouldn't be outlandish at all. I guess you look at Colton Cowser, near big league ready, Connor Norby, Jordan Westberg, Kobe Mayo. This list is ridiculous. This group of players, last year was such a huge year for this group. So many of these guys moved up and did well. It's incredible to see that sort of development. So I think they're going to probably take advantage of that and turn at least one of those guys, maybe even more than one of those guys, into some help for this rotation. I mean, right now it's Gibson, Kramer, Bradish, Wells, and Grayson Rodriguez. I'm sure we'll see DL Hall getting big league innings at some point this year. That's not enough. If they want to be a team that makes a run and plays meaningful games deep into September, I think they need more in this rotation.
Oh, they absolutely do. I'm not a Bradish guy. I mean, his ERA masks some not great peripherals. I've really never bought the delivery. I think it's just hard. It can be hard for him to even see average command with that delivery. I love DL Hall's stuff. He just flat out has to throw more strikes. And he's fine, not great in that department so far this year. I'm just eyeballing this. What is that? About 12% walk rate. He might be able to get away with it in the big leagues. He could be a 10-11% walk rate guy and still be valuable because I think he's going to miss a lot of bats. It's still not ideal. It's not a contending rotation. I know they're off to a great start. The record is good. They need more. And I agree with you. I said this coming out of last season. Baltimore has this group of position player prospects that's reasonably close to the majors. They're never going to be able to play all these guys. And that's even before we consider Jackson Holliday and the guys from last year's draft who are all now in high A. There's a logjam coming. You have to trade from surplus here because you're going to end up in a spot where either one, guys stop playing and then they start to lose value essentially, or other teams are just going to look and say, why would we give you full price for that particular player? Because we know you can't keep him. We know you don't have room for him. So I thought there was a real opportunity for them this past winter to try to do that, convert a few of those guys for an arm, kind of what you suggest if they'd gone to Cleveland and said, here's three or four really good position player prospects for the next 2 years of Shane Bieber. I don't know if Cleveland would have said yes or not. They've done deals like that before. Maybe they would have. And it would have clearly benefited Baltimore.
Nice to see Heston Kerstad finally healthy as well. He's at AA right now, yes. 15 games there. 377 for the OBP, a 644 slug thanks to six homers already in 15 games. Probably a guy that's not going to be at AA for very long. If this continues for a few more weeks, he's probably in AAA by, the end of May?
I would assume so, because he's an older guy. I also really want to see this guy's he's got to get to an age-appropriate level and see some better pitching. I really want to see that. I really want to see him against better pitching, because when I have, in the last year, seen him against better quality stuff, it hasn't been great. But he's also been rusty, right? This guy missed two full calendar years of baseball. So there's also the chance that, and I said this in everything I wrote about him last year, I probably used the word rust multiple times every single time. It could be that we're finally getting the Heston Kerstad that the Orioles thought they were getting when they took him with the second overall pick in 2020, the guy who was one of the better power hitters in the SEC in his draft class.
Yeah, certainly looks like it early on here in 2023. Michael Busch getting a quick look with the Dodgers, what I assume to be a quick look because Max Muncy was on the paternity list. That was the move that brought Michael Busch up. Dodgers have had a ton of players on and off the paternity list here early on this season. Michael Busch, we thought, had maybe a path to this roster anyway just because of the Gavin Lux injury and the depth maybe not being quite what it was in past years for the Dodgers. I'm just curious if you think there's more than an up and down role for him this season. I mean, he's old enough to stick in the big leagues based on the fact that he's already spent over 600 plate appearances at the AAA level. There's really nothing left for him to prove in the minors.
Yeah, I mean, this is a cautionary tale for the Orioles, right? Where the Dodgers don't have a clear place for him to play, unless they were going to send Miguel Vargas down or something like that. But I don't think that's imminent. And now what? I mean, really, now what? What do you do with Busch? He needs to play in the big leagues. He's not going to continue developing in AAA. He's not going to gain value. He may lose value if you send him to AAA. He's not gaining value if he's sitting on the bench in the majors. But he's good enough to play every day for probably 20 teams right now, 15 to 20 teams, certainly. And so, yeah, I wonder if the Dodgers make some choice to keep him up and try to move him around a little bit just to try to get him some playing time. They have an actual crunch there. Once Muncy is back, I'm guessing Bush does go back down and that his opportunity for regular playing time probably just depends on somebody getting hurt or I guess an unforeseen trade, right? Maybe they trade him. I mean, that might be the best scenario. We just don't see trades typically this early in the season, but you know, if you're the Dodgers, you do have actual needs. Maybe you go to other clubs and say, look, we love Michael Bush. We just don't have a place to play him. And trust me, there's lots of other clubs that would be very happy to take Michael Bush and just install him directly in the big leagues, a guy who makes the minimum salary and could be, I think you could reasonably say be an average or slightly above average player at second base for the rest of this year.
Yeah, it seems like we're getting enough chaos to maybe see a few more early season trades than usual this year, just based on how the first month is playing out. Maybe it's just me wishcasting those trades. Mm-hmm. And Miguel Vargas, by the way, who's been playing a lot so far to begin the season. I know he had that thumb injury back during spring training. He was taking plate appearances and not swinging the bat back during the spring. Mm-hmm. Slugging .309 so far, which makes me wonder if he's still not healthy. So there could be another path to the roster if they want to send Vargas down for a bit or even just give him a couple of weeks on the IL to possibly heal up that injury if it's still lingering. That could be another way for Michael Bush to hang around or get a call back up to LA in the somewhat near future. Staying in the NL West, talking about the Rockies for a moment, Brenton Doyle, a 2019 fourth round pick out of Shepherd University, that's D2, and I didn't know this, Keith, that's located in West Virginia. He is kind of interesting.
I know that from when he was drafted. I didn't know that before he was drafted.
I had never heard of Shepherd University prior to making this rundown. He's got some power, he's got some speed, there are some questions about his plate skills. Pretty unusual player, though, and a kind of a pop-up guy that getting playing time in Colorado could make him interesting to some folks.
Yeah, he's really toolsy. He just strikes out way too much. I mean, I don't see any path to any, like, I don't think he's anything more than an up and down guy. I would love to see him succeed. I think it's great when guys from smaller schools, I think the story with him was he was going to play at VMI and they yanked his scholarship kind of at the last second. So he transferred to Shepherd. Basically walked on, obviously was the best player in school history. I think they've produced three big leaguers and none since the draft first became a thing. And he can run and it's legit power. It was 27 homers last year, 26 homers last year. Some was in AAA, but a lot was in AA. He also punched out 171 times. I mean, this guy is going to strike out a third or more of his plate appearances in the big leagues. And that's even giving him a little bit of credit for playing half his games at altitude. I hope that's wrong. Like I said, I'm a big fan of guys, JUCO guys, small school guys, NAIA guys, guys who come from countries where we don't get a lot of players. Like, that's all great for the sport. My realistic side looks at Doyle and I've seen him and I look at his history and this is just not likely.
There was another player I stumbled into doing some prep for some drafts back in March, Vaughn Brown in the Giants organization. Another player that has a pretty unusual path. I think Florida Southern College is where he went. He was a 10th round pick. He's already 24 years old. He's on the minor league IL right now, but
yeah, he hasn't played yet this year, right?
He hasn't played yet this year, but put up some big numbers while being very old for the level at both of his A-ball stops last year.
Yep, he can really run. He can really run. And he's probably a plus defender in center. He's had knee issues, which is really scary for a guy whose number one and number two tools basically revolve around his legs. I actually tried to see him. I got two games at the end of the spring with the Giants minor league group, and he didn't play. He wasn't playing at all. He was just taking a sort of soft swings in the cage. I think he got into a couple of spring training games, tweaked one of the knees. He hurt one knee at the end of last year. I was going to go down to Richmond and see him when he got a very late promotion. He played one game, got hurt in the first game. Coming back this spring, hurts the other knee. None of this is incredibly serious, but you just don't love hearing about knee problems with guys who run and who depend on the running speed for a good chunk of their value, which is a long way of saying this guy's not actually taken a real at bat outside of those couple spring training games since right around Labor Day. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to see him, not for lack of effort. I have actually tried to see this guy because, like you said, he raked at both levels of A-ball, but he was 24 in low A to start the year. That tells us basically nothing. Until this guy, he'll be 25 in, I assume, in double A when he comes back, that's still too old for the level. But at least if he goes there, we're getting closer, right? Eventually it stops. I don't care if you're 30 in the big leagues. If you're in the big leagues, that's all that matters. He's got to get back. And then I would really like to see him maintain the contact, which is the thing when I talked to scouts who did see him during the year, I didn't have any scouts say, hey, this guy's like a 30-30 guy or something, or he's a potential superstar. A lot of guys liked him. They said speed, defense. There's some real power. He can put a charge into a ball, but he's probably not going to hit enough to become that kind of player. And we won't really have any evidence to the contrary, probably until he gets to AAA at this point, given how old he is.
Yeah, could be a pretty quick to the big league sort of player, though, if he dominates once he's healthy again this season. Florida Southern College, by the way, two very long-term big leaguers, Matt Joyce and Brett Tomko, both went there, among others. They've had 14 players reach the big leagues.
Nice pull. Yeah, he was a fifth-year, Brown was, he was a fifth-year senior, essentially. He was a COVID senior. They call him super seniors sometimes. So he played five seasons at Florida Southern. That's why he's old. Now, that's not his fault, and we're going to see a few of them this year. I ran into a grad student was it Arkansas, Wagner, who was early in the season, and I happened to get the exit velos, and he was topping out at like 112. Like, someone is going to sign that guy, not for a ton of money or the high pick, and that's great. I mean, what an amazing outcome for him. But then you're 23, and suddenly it's, all right, let's go. How quick can we get you to AA because you're 23?
One more NL West thing to get to before we go. More shuffling in Arizona. Madison Bumgarner was released after being designated for assignment last week. Talked about him on last week's show. One of our listeners pointed out the dirt bike accident. That really was a bit of a turning point. And maybe it just lined up with aging and regression anyway, but it was something that I had forgotten about. Plus, he took a comebacker to his pitching wrist the year after in spring training. So a couple of pretty bad injuries may have led to the beginning of the end for Madison Bumgarner. But the Diamondbacks continue to manage their roster in a way that I would describe as very serious. They're playing for now. Jake McCarthy, who played really well last year, has been optioned down. Alec Thomas's role, I think, becomes even more stable. I think he's the kind of guy that would have lost time if McCarthy was going to stay on the roster. And they optioned Dre Jameson down, which I think is more to keep him stretched out at AAA Reno, even though they had been using him in the bullpen before they moved him briefly into their rotation. Keith, this has to mean Brandon Pfaadt is on the way up, right? It seems inevitable.
You would hope so, right? Last I looked, he was pitching great. Stuff was great. Results were there. This is the best of their pitching prospects, and they've got a nice table of pitching prospects coming, too. So that is not any skin off some of the other guys, but Pfaadt is he's not their number one. They don't need him to be the number one, but he's in that rotation. He could be their number three starter for the remainder of the season. I mean, number three in terms of the third best performer among their starters for the rest of the season. I think he's pretty clearly ready. It does come up. It's not quite the same as the other situations we were talking about where, the Diamondbacks have been trying other prospects also, Jameson being one of them, Ryan Nelson, like that is, they're not just messing around, but at a certain point, you just got to again, look and say, is Brandon Pfaadt the best actual option? He is the fourth best starter in the organization right now. Call him up. I do want to mention, by the way, I'm glad you threw Alec Thomas's name out there too. I was always a big fan of Thomas as a prospect going back to high school. But the one thing that became a bit of a concern, and this carried forward to last year, and where I think they ended up optioning him late in the season, was that he just wasn't hitting the ball hard at all. And we have now in a fair, it's what has he got, 55 batted ball events so far this year, but most of his indicators are up quite a bit. So I am hopeful. I always think of it as cautious optimism. We're this early in the season. People love to say these numbers have stabilized. That's not what that means. This is not definitive. He's got to carry this out. He's got to hold this over a longer period. But if Alec Thomas is able to hit the ball harder, and he's actually improved his launch angle too, into a range where he's more likely to get to line drives, this guy can run. He can play the hell out of center field. He will be a big league regular. And, maybe it's just a matter of he just needs more playing time, because his performance so far this year, just the superficial performance, does not back that up. But the underlying data that we have so far on his batted balls is really, really good. So if if you got Alec Thomas on your fantasy team, hold on to him. I was going to say, if you're a Diamondbacks fan, are there any Diamondbacks fans?
There's a few.
I'm going to hear from him now, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I think that's the thing. The surface numbers don't look good, but everything else we care about looks like it's going in the right direction. And part of the appeal of Alec Thomas, because he's a great defender, he will get a lot of opportunities to play. So yeah, I think from a fantasy perspective, absolutely. The kind of guy that's probably freely available on the wire right now that you could pick up, and he'll make a surprising impact for you because he has some speed too. Stolen bases, I know they're up around the league, but guys that can run a little bit, they always help out. Could be a nice five category player if it all comes together and it looks like the signs are there.
I'll take four, right? If the homers aren't there, yeah. But he's hitting for average. Doubles, you know, he'll have some of that speed power, right? Where it's doubles and triples because he gets the extra base. If he hits for average, you'll get the, you know, it's more of a baseball thing, less of a fantasy thing. But if he hits for average, then the defense really, it matters. He's got enough glove, speed. As long as he's making better quality contact, that'll make him an everyday player. And you'll get that playing time.
I don't see a lot of 9.1% barrel rates with a .338 slugging percentage next to them. That, to me, screams of some early season bad luck with some of those balls in play for Alec Thomas. You can see it. It's in the BABIP, 208 BABIP, too. For a guy hitting the ball that hard, that's not normal. There's correction coming with Alec Thomas. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. If you don't have a subscription, get one for $1 a month for the first year at theathletic.com/baseball show. You find Keith on Twitter at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. We're back with you on Monday.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.